Hello and welcome to The Tidal Year, the podcast that discovers the joys of swimming. My name is Freya and joining me today is Lizzie Stewart, an illustrator and the author of the graphic novel, Alison. She joined me to talk about creativity in swimming, painting water, and how a visit to the pond calms her brain. Enjoy! Before we dive into this episode, I'd like to thank today's sponsor, TryHard. I love being in the water, but I don't love what pool chemicals like chlorine do for my skin and hair. TryHard develop water sports specialized skin and hair solutions that eliminate those negative effects of pool chemicals and ocean salts. I'm thrilled to share with all listeners of the Tidal Year a very exclusive 15% off when you use code TIDAL at tryhard.co. Thank you so much for joining me, Lizzie. It's lovely to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first, I'd love to talk about your fantastic graphic novel called Alison. And when I read it and actually reread it recently, the heroine felt so real to me. The story kind of follows her as a young artist moving from the coast in Dorset to London and finding her artistic voice in the 1970s. And she just feels so honest to me, and actually not just like a woman of that era, but of many women now and probably forever. But she's actually a fictional character. So tell me a little bit about Alison in your graphic novel and how the idea even came about.
I'm very glad she feels real. I mean, obviously, to me, she feels very real because she's lived in my head for quite a while. But I think she kind of came from a kind of box or envelope, folder, that's the word I'm looking for, folder of writing that my mum had of my grandma's writing, kind of creative writing, bit of essay writing that she made in her early 20s when she was living in a house on the coast in Dorset and she was newly married. And she was sort of writing about the sea, obviously, because she was a woman in her early 20s living by the sea. So obviously there was a lot of sea love happening. And then there was also a lot about, who am I going to be? What am I going to do? I'd like to make art. Will I get to make art? How will I get to make art? I've got a child. What am I, you know, what is my life going to be? And it felt very familiar. It felt timeless to read her thoughts from the 60s as though they were thoughts written by one of my friends right now, I suppose, because people think about the same things regardless of era. A lot of our internal stuff remains the same. So it kind of reading that and knowing I knew at the time that I had the vaguest idea for a story, and reading her writing was kind of the something I could tether it to, something I could build the character from this seed, even though Alison in the story is a completely different woman ultimately than my grandmother was. It was this real thing that I could root it in that meant I felt secure and safe to kind of take it where I wanted. So she came sort of from real life, but then she also comes from people I know, things that happen to everyone and things that don't happen to everyone, but you hear about. She's on a sort of a journey to become an artist, but also just she's just living her life. So a lot of it is about friendship. There's a hefty amount about relationships, but I think the driving force throughout her life is friendship, hopefully.
Oh, I love that there's so much friendship in it, and there's so much in it that I related to, just about relationships and creativity and feeling like a huge part of access to creativity is often through relationships, or especially relationships with older men who feel credible. And my own ideas have not felt credible. And so I really related to that. But what I loved was that the romance in the story didn't really come from that. The romance came from the relationship with the friend, because I think actually like sisterhood doesn't often get enough credit as being the driving force of so much romance in our lives. And the little notes back and forth between Alison and Tess, I just loved, because I've never really received love letters from a partner, but I do receive letters from my best friend, and I keep them all, and often think I don't give enough credit to how romantic that relationship is. And we like to say we kind of fell in love at first sight. And I loved being able to identify that in your book. I just think it's so lovely.
Oh, thank you. And I'm delighted you've got a long-term romantic friendship.
A pen pal.
Yeah, I think they're really special. And I do think there's so many markers in a life for things that relate to a relationship. A traditional romantic relationship, getting married, having a child, buying a house, all these things that are kind of celebrated. But you could live your entire life with one best friend and care about them from your childhood to the end of your days. And there's no prize for that. But that will be the thing for many people that defines their entire life. And I feel very lucky to have two friends that I made kind of in my first week of university, who are both definitely heavily influencing Tessa and Alison, actually. Yeah, and I kind of wanted to celebrate them without creeping them out too much, although I don't know if that worked.
Yeah, my book that's coming out soon, I wrote a lot about my friend in it, and also had to have that conversation with her where I said, I've been writing about you and I've kind of written a book about us. And yeah. It was interesting to have that conversation and to have a new layer of being able to share to them how important they are to me. But I'd love to know as well, you kind of mentioned the word friend in relation to your grandmother as well. And I guess with parents and with grandparents, they're these parental authority figures for a lot of our life. And then as you get a bit older, you maybe remember that they have hopes and dreams and creative ambitions and their own sexuality. And it must have been incredibly intimate to read those letters. Do you feel like it enabled you to have almost like a friendship with your grandmother for the first time?
Yeah, so she died when I was nine. So although she was a very big part of my childhood, yeah, my adult life, sadly, she hasn't been there. But she is very present, I think, in my family in general. I think we all recognise her at various things. I know that all the women in my family recognise her in our own anxieties. We're like, oh, God, thanks, Grandma, good job. But reading the writing was very interesting because she obviously aspired towards writing, but this was her like really early stuff. So she's literally 22, 23 writing this. So it isn't brilliant, but I found its lack of brilliance way more moving than I might have done had it been a perfectly polished personal essay or something. It was sort of, it felt familiar and it felt like, oh yeah, I could pick you up and drop you into my friendship group at that age and it would have been fine. We would have all made sense of each other, which is a really nice feeling. And you also get that with your parents sometimes. You know, when you see, there's a lot of, the book is presented, lots of it is like a scrapbook, so there's photos and that is directly kind of drawn from family photos and how much I like looking at them as a child and working out who was who, and then looking at my parents when they were teenagers and their friends. And I think you get that same feeling of sometimes looking at a photo of your parents and being like, oh yeah, we would have been friends, or oh my gosh, you were way cooler than I was. And I love that. And I think that is one of those early storytelling experiences that you don't know you're having when you're a child, looking at photos that you weren't around for and sort of filling in the gaps yourself. So I wanted to recreate that in the book. But there's a lot of, the reader has to do a bit of work, I suppose, when they're looking at the photos or drawn photos to work out what happens.
And it's so rewarding because you're looking at all of these little snippets of vignettes of a life and, you know, ticket stubs and gallery notices and photos and letters and things on backs of envelopes, which I just love because that's what life is. And I guess there's quite a lot that we can tell from what someone chooses to keep. And the other joy of that with, you know, family is that the discovery kind of goes on forever. I always feel like I know my parents quite well, whilst at the same time not really knowing them at all. And some, you know, we recently actually got a photo album out, and I'm always reminded that I should do that kind of thing more, because you see new photos or things that you hadn't recognized as much the first time. And I saw some photos of my mum and dad when they just got together, and my older brothers, who are my half brothers from my dad's first marriage. And I hadn't really noticed or thought that the photos of my mum and dad, where they're looking very in love and like having a kiss, would have been taken by my older brother when they were a child. And that thinking about that and the intimacy of that moment really added a new, especially because my mum would have been the age that I am now. To think about that really gave me a new level of understanding or closeness to her.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You're right. I also feel like I should do it more. Like, really grill them. What's happening here? Well, who are these people? And now and again, you can sort of coax it out of them. But it's also fun just to look and sort of work it out. And yeah, have that moment where you're like, oh, I see, that must have been this. I recognise that feeling. We're all just people.
We're all just people. One moment in the book that I just love is towards the end. Alison is, hopefully this isn't a spoiler, but I also think the joy of Alison is in reading and viewing and touching it, and that she's being introduced for an event as an artist, and someone reads a biography for her, and she has this, you kind of get a sense of the expression on her face, which is a bit daunted or not even recognizing herself, of like, wow, my life and my career sounds so grand and important. Mm. And it doesn't, you know, I guess part of the point of the book is that you have all these photos and these letters and these moments, and that life is made up of moments. And for somebody to read your biography is maybe not how real it feels. As an artist, do you find that? I mean, like being on a podcast like this and someone's emailing you, like, I'd love to talk to you and your career is amazing. And you think, well, I'm just me. That's incredibly intimidating. Do you relate to that feeling?
Yeah. I mean, luckily hers sounds quite grand. She's in her 60s by the end of the book. So there's a lot of stuff and there's accolades to run through. I can't claim to have that kind of biography behind me. But definitely, you never recognise yourself in a list of achievements, because those will have been one day out of hundreds and thousands, and they don't feel like your life at all. If anything, they feel like things that happen outside of your life, that weird day where you got a prize or something. So yeah, and she doesn't necessarily recognize her own experience in that biography, but that's the biography that you get as an artist or as a person who exists in a vaguely public way. You get this biography, and I think when I was planning the book, she sort of, that the idea of her biography on paper and then her biography as it would have been lived interested me, because you read these when you're reading about great male artists. So Alison has sort of a relationship with an older male artist, but when you read about these big names, there's often this one or two sentences referencing the woman he was with, and it will say something like, she was also a painter, she was also a photographer, and then that's it, and then you never hear about her ever again. And some of those women have come to the fore in recent years and are being rediscovered and celebrated for the work that they made, but that someone's bio, you would be a footnote in someone else's biography, felt a little sad. So I wanted Alison to have a rich life behind the scenes.
It's really beautiful to see that, and it's crazy that that's still happening today. I'm a big fan of like the Great Women Artist podcast with Katie Hassel, and I know she's a fan of your book, and it's been such a joy to discover so many people through that I didn't really know, and yet I did know their male counterparts. And that's, I mean, for 2023 to still be having that, but I'm really pleased that the tide is turning, so to speak, on that. But you know, although this story is set in the 1970s, I think that does still feel quite real, that met, you know, that mentor mentee relationship and how that intersects with sex and love and relationships and creativity, I think is often very interesting.
When you stumble across someone who, like, I should have been looking at these paintings my entire life. I think I felt that when I first saw Pauline Boaty's paintings after I'd graduated from art school. I was like, oh my God, if I'd seen these like 6 months ago, everything would be different. Yeah, it's mad.
Yeah, and I wonder if they arrive to you at the time that you need them. And I love this idea that Alison is like a biography in a different kind, because it's so true. When you often read a biography of an artistic figure, it is so much about accolades and achievements, but not, you know, the beautiful details of like, did they live by the sea? Did they fall in love and out of love? What happened there? I had the weird experience of having to do the biography for my book recently. And the publisher very much encouraged me, like, oh, put something fun in there so that people know you're real. And I was quite resistant to wanting, you know, the example they gave me was Freya Bromley, podcaster and writer, and plant mama to 100 succulents or something like that. And I felt very resistant to that, which I think was actually says quite a lot about me, that I wanted to be taken very seriously and I wanted it to sound very serious. Whereas you might meet other people that for their biography, they want it to have a lot of humor in it or for it not to feel like it's bigging anything up. And I think we can tell quite a lot of people about people through that, especially in an age of social media where people are having to put themselves in, you know, 180 characters and sum up themselves and who they are.
Yeah. And also, who gets asked to lighten up their biography? It's because it's not everyone. Or who has to add a fun little detail? Not everyone gets asked to do that. And why is that? Why are the Booker Prize winners not being asked to include how many cups of tea they drink a day or whatever it is? It's definitely slight, maybe it's slightly gendered, slightly age related. I don't know.
It's just Silly Little Women with our silly little stories.
Yes. If you will write your silly little books, you have to talk about your silly little lives as well.
Oh, I know. And I'm really trying to be resistant to that, in that I've been to a few book talks event recently to kind of almost do my homework of what it feels like to be in that space. And I do notice other people do it being so self-deprecating about their work and saying, oh, I don't know, I guess I just wrote this little thing. And I'm really trying hard not to do that, because it's interesting that that's the instinct. And I guess Alison has that in that moment where she's thinking, oh, that's not me.
Yeah, she plays it down. But also I understand, I think being self-deprecating, people have pivoted to being quite hard on it. Oh, don't sell yourself short or whatever, which is fair enough. But I think sometimes you do feel like, but it's just what I do. It's a habit that I have that's got out of control and I've done this little book or whatever. I think it's also fine to be maybe a bit realistic and a bit, I don't know, to see proportion in what you're doing. Yeah, no, it is an achievement, but it is also my job. So I'm not a special genius angel baby who's done this. I'm being paid to do this. This is what I do every single day. So I should have made a book, or I should have done these paintings, or whatever it is. Anyway, that's besides the point. I don't know where I'm going.
I love that we're talking about biographies and feeling confident. And I'm actually going to read to you from your own acknowledgements, which I'm sure will really embarrass you. But I got to the end of Alison, having absolutely loved it, and saw that you said in your acknowledgements, and to Kerry Hindman for swimming round and round a chilly pond with me whilst I waited to see if anyone else was interested in it. And I was so happy to hear that you're a swimmer. So I'd love to ask you about swimming, and also about swimming while you were writing Alison. Where were you swimming at that time, or when you were waiting to hear if anybody was interested to publish it? What time of year was it? What do you remember about what must have been both a very exciting and anxiety inducing period of your life?
So the book was drawn and written during lockdown, so I was not swimming anywhere and I was unhappy. swimming obviously is very good for your health and for your brain, but I hadn't realised how important it was for my brain on a day-to-day basis. Either to know, oh, I'm going for a swim tomorrow, or oh, I went for a swim yesterday. You feel kind of reassured by it, maybe. And so not having that for some months was strange. And then I'd finished the book and it was out on submission, and that's when I think lockdown lifted sufficiently that you could do outdoor swimming. And so my friend Kerry and I started going to Beckenham Pond in South London. So it was like four stops on the train from where I used to live. So it was very quick, and nice little walk then from the station to the pond. We met there every other day in the morning, and we started in September, I think. So maybe it had been open during the summer, I think, but it had been rammed all the time because it was one of 10 things you could do with your time at that point. So we started going in September. So as the seasons were changing, we were going sort of fairly frequently, and then making the transition to wearing gloves and boots when you're swimming, and then full wetsuit around November, December-ish. And yeah, we just kept going. And so I really, really associate the weirdness of knowing that your work, which you will know that feeling of knowing that something that is so personal, that you've put so much time in, is in the hands of people you've never met. You can't stand behind them and go like, oh, well, I might change that bit, or I don't mind if you think that's not good. You can't do that. You can't do that. You just have to let it go and let it be in the world. And swimming was quite calming. And I spoke to Kerry about it to update her on, I think they liked it. Okay, that's happening. Yeah, and it was, we swam up until the next lockdown, so the Christmas 2020. And then through January, February, we couldn't, and then we went back in spring. Yeah, and so the whole process of the book getting picked up and going through editing, I really associate specifically with Beckenham Pond and wetsuits.
Oh, what a magical time that must have been, especially to look back on and to not be in the midst of it. And for listeners who might not have been to Beckenham Place, it's just wonderful. It's kind of like a big stately manor on a small hill. And then below it, there's almost like, I think it's a man-made pond, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a golf course. So it was the whole, yeah, that part of the park was a golf course. And I think the lake was, I guess it was a hazard, a golf hazard that they sort of expanded. So it's man-made, but there's ducks and geese and ducklings floating around as you swim. And it's quite big for, it's bigger, I guess it's bigger than the ladies' pond, which is where the other main outdoor swimming place in London that I would go to.
And I feel like the ladies' pond has, the water is quite brown, almost amber coloured, whereas the water at Beckenham I always feel is very green and has much more of like a river feel to it. And especially when it gets to, well, around kind of like September time, it does feel so green, and there's wonderful river plants there, pond plants. And something I love is that they give you a float, like a fluorescent float for when you swim, that you have to have, that the lifeguards give you, but makes it quite nice that you can almost float rather than swim a bit more. And I find that I kind of notice the nature around me when I do that. So it's always quite a relaxing place to be swimming.
I totally agree. I love the floats. I love the floats. And it's a bit, okay, I'm testing out a thought that I'm having right now. This could go very off piece. But that having the float is like, so it's a fluorescent float that means that if you get into trouble, they can spot you easily. But it reminds me obviously of having kind of armbands when you're a kid, and or having one of those foam board floats. And as much as you use it for swimming, you also use it for play and for relaxing, and yeah, for bobbing around. And it was such a nice thing to have. And a bit like, as an illustrator making picture books are the thing that you're really urged to grow out of. You don't need this anymore. And actually, it's nice to have it sometimes. It doesn't matter if you don't technically need it. Having the float, it's really relaxing. And it does allow you to just enjoy being in the water and kind of look around. And yeah, particularly in September, October, when the water is, that's the best temperature for the water. For me, maybe other people like it warmer. Some people like it colder. I don't know what's wrong with them. But yeah, 14, 15, it's a lovely. And yeah, you can just sort of bob about and have a look. And Beckenham's really good for that, I think, because it's so big, I suppose there's space to bob.
You're so right. I love bobbing about. I try and like balance on my front on it and kind of splash about. I try and rest it beneath my head and see how long I can balance there for. And you just have a bit of a play. But I would know, I've actually got a toe float. I never take it anywhere with me. I feel like I'd look too silly. Whereas because you're forced to have it there, it's quite nice. And I've been to Beckenham Place with my godfather. And it's so funny, just the two of us being there, kind of acting like kids. And I like that because it makes it a little bit silly. Obviously, there are people there that are there to do what looks like real triathlon swimming as well. And they're just dragging the float behind them. But I think it's quite nice when you see a lot of adults in their swimming cozies and their swimming trunks bobbing about having a play.
Yeah, I think because you can't do that in an indoor pool as an adult. You absolutely can't bob about and try and do handstands and stuff like that, the things you would do in the pool as a child. So, yeah, the pond, that particular pond, I would say, is quite freeing in that respect. The ladies' pond is more sociable, and that's people are sort of chatting there. And then the mixed pond is kind of it's a wild card. You never know what vibe you're going to get in the mixed pond, but I do like it. But,
you're so right. It's very true about that. Sometimes I feel like I'm a bit of an outsider. There seem to be lots of people that know each other, and I always feel like a bit of a spare part. Or other times it's very chatty and very nice. Yeah, you're right. You do.
Sometimes it's really quiet.
Mm.
And it's pond at the end of tail end of the summer. You can get a really lovely quiet day. But Beckenham has a playfulness. I think there's something, because you, for better or worse, you get changed, very exposed in essentially the middle of the park. It's fenced off, but that is no barrier between you and the path and the dog walkers as you're trying to wrestle yourself into your swimming gear. But I think the madness of that and the out of the ordinariness of getting ready in such an exposed location sort of sends you a bit mad. And there is a kind of, there's a slightly hilarious energy. And then people screeching as they get into cold water, and big groups of women chatting as they swim around in bobble hats and stuff. I think it's quite a joyful place. Yeah, it's a fun one.
It really is, because you're kind of bonded by looking at other strangers doing the same thing, getting their kit off by the pool and yanking wetsuits and neoprene socks off. And you kind of share these looks of, well, this is mad, isn't it? And I do find that quite nice. I guess being your own boss and being a freelancer in many ways is just joyous and wonderful, but also must be quite isolating. Mm. Is swimming almost part of having a community or that daily connection? Do you chat to people, or even if you're not chatting to people, sometimes, you know, at the ladies' pond, which is often quite quiet, but it's nice just to be around people?
Yes, it's very nice to be around people. The ladies' pond is a very specific experience. Like, I go with friends, but I do love going alone. And I love, yeah, the feeling of just being surrounded by women doing that, having their own little, I suppose, slightly ritual moment, and hearing other people's chatter as you're swimming past them, and then sometimes slowing down so you can hear the end of the story. But the socialness, so yeah, I was swimming with my friend Kerry for a couple of years, and then she moved to Scotland, traitor. Has moved to the edge of a loch where she can swim all the time. So I lost my, because I think it's also about finding someone who you're matched with swim-wise in terms of how often you want to do it, what temperatures you find comfortable, the kind of swimming you want to do. We had a really nice, I think we were in quite a nice rhythm and quite happy. Although she was a bit hardier than me and could stay in the water longer in the deep winter. But without that, I now have friends who I swim sporadically with, but I don't have at the moment a kind of co-swim friend. But that's okay. I think I quite like being able to get up and do it whenever I like. And obviously that's a real bonus of being freelance, of sticking your head out the window in the morning and being like, oh, I'm gonna do it now. And it's very tempting today. The sky is so blue, even though I went to Beckenham on Monday. And it was my first outdoor swim this year. And it was quite chilly. It was a little cold for me.
Yeah, I keep thinking next time I go, it'll be warm now. And it's still not. But, you know, that's okay.
I got out of the habit this year because we were moving house. And so nowhere, we don't have anywhere. As Beckenham's a bit further, Hampstead's a bit further. So I think in winter you need to be able to pop out and do it, I think, with relative ease, and it became a bit of a mission to get there. So it is quite tempting to do that.
That's why I find having a friend good for that, is because it's suddenly the accountability of, we're booked at this time, so we're going to meet. And I think I'm very good at persuading myself out of it because it's cold, or I've actually got loads of things to do now. And so I find having my friends quite a good accountability partner. But I, for a long time, didn't really have anybody to go swimming with. And I would go to the Lido or the ponds a lot on my own, which was always very lovely. But I began to get very interested in going to places further. I wanted to have somebody who would come to Brighton or Cornwall with me. And so I actually went on a women's swimming holiday where there was about 12 people that had all gone on their own and suddenly had all these friends that wanted to swim. And that was, yeah, that was really good, actually. And through that, I think sometimes when I have someone with me, I get a bit more confident to talk to other people at the ponds anyway.
Yeah, definitely. And that, like, people do chat, particularly at Beckenham. It's very chatty by the side of the water, which is really nice. And even just that 5-minute snippet that you have with someone can change if you're having a very solitary freelance day. It can change the mood of your day quite nicely. But also, yeah, just sort of acknowledging this mad thing that you're doing, if it's very cold or it's raining, is nice. Yeah, it is. I think I tend towards being a shy person, or historically I've tended towards being a shy person. So those situations that sort of force you out of it and offer an easy connection to someone, I think swimming really does that. But at the moment I'm swimming indoors in the pool nearest my studio, which is weirdly a place where I don't want any interaction. It's the complete opposite.
Why do you think that is? That's interesting.
It is interesting. Is it? One of the reasons is that I'm swimming with goggles and face in the water swimming, proper swimming, and I don't have my glasses on, so I can't really see. And that makes me feel like I'm in a little bubble. But also that then if someone talks to me, I can't really see them properly. I mean, I can see the shape of them, but they're very blurry. And that makes me feel quite uneasy and quite, I suppose I feel exposed. Like, they can see me, but I'm looking at a blurry shape. So I don't really like that. I suppose there's something about being in an interior maybe makes you feel more private. Not everyone feels more private. Recently I've encountered many men who just want to have a chat, and it's not the time. Yeah, and just generally the experience of being in an indoor pool is very different than being outdoors. Even than being outdoors in a lie down. I still really enjoy it. I'll take what I can get, but it's definitely a different brain for each.
Yeah, I agree. I guess because there's like the order of the lanes, which makes you feel like I'm here to do a thing and I'm going to go and do it. But also I feel like I'm connected to almost like a bravery or a courage when I'm outdoors and when it's cold that makes me feel not as shy as normal, and also connects me to this part that's like, I'm going to speak to somebody because I'm doing this crazy thing that inside I don't feel like I'm doing something extraordinary. So it doesn't almost motivate me to break that quite as much. And I mean, the main reason I never get into indoor swimming is the same problem as you, that I have glasses. I've tried prescription goggles. They always leak. I hate not being able to see anything. And I never put my head underwater.
Yeah, it's a real problem. I've actually never tried prescription goggles, which is a bit ridiculous. And I should probably give it a go. And definitely sometimes you get a pair of goggles that you're like, oh, in the water, I can see really well through these. There's obviously something in the thickness of these lenses that matches my prescription. But yeah, it is quite disorienting to be out in the world without your glasses or without your contact lenses. So yeah, I think I just have to power through because it's right next door to my studio. So it'd be mad not to use it.
And it's interesting that you mentioned picture books earlier, because I guess picture books are very childish and playful. And really, that's one of the wonderful things about drawing, is that without words, well, illustration, without words, you can convey quite a lot. And I always love your illustrations of swimmers or swimming. When you're thinking about painting a scene from water, what are some of the things that you feel like you can convey in an image that is more difficult to convey in text? I mean, I guess I'm asking you to explain that in words when that in itself feels difficult.
Yeah, so the painting is the explanation, isn't it? Much like a passage of writing is the explanation for how you feel about being in water or looking at water or whatever. The painting is the explanation because I can't put it in words. So what I'm often trying to do is, yeah, recreate the feeling of being in water, whether that is it being warm and sunny or cold and murky, or just the feeling of being enveloped in it, which I think is the thing that I've loved my entire life. I mean, like, I've always loved being in water, maybe more than the swimming, or just like being in the water. So it's often trying to recreate that, the feeling of it around you. But I don't know. I don't know. It's one of those things that you don't think about when you do. Much like writing, it's very hard to explain the work once it's done in many ways. That's the thing. The thing is that, and to describe it is just to add another layer of kind of nonsense over the top that doesn't really add anything, which makes, like talk as you will, I'm sure, enjoy in the future, sometimes talking about something doesn't really do anything extra, doesn't explain the book anymore. I imagine, particularly not if it's a personal piece of writing and you're writing about your own experiences. You're like, it's all there, I've done it, I can't answer any more questions, this is as much as I've got. And I think with drawing, painting about swimming is mostly, just trying to communicate the feeling, which I don't think I always manage. It's quite hard, but it's fun. Painting water is fun. Painting scenes with water in, I think most pictures look better with a bit of water in.
Yeah, especially if there's a few ducks in there.
Yeah.
You're right, though. I think that's fun. It always feels a bit naff when people say, oh, well, writing or drawing or anything is like breathing to me. And that feels like a bit of a cop-out. But it's true in some senses that some things are very instinctive to us and they feel that they are a necessity to life. And I guess that's part of why I'm interested in this podcast, is talking to people, trying to almost articulate why swimming is so special. And I'm always very interested in the ways that people are able to capture that, because it's always very different, but very similar, really. I remember I was actually just thinking about a chat I had with Marika Hackman, who said, it's like being hugged by liquid. And, you know, you saying about that sensation of being enveloped in water is very similar. And I guess one thing I was going to ask you was just about, I know people ask you a lot, well, why do you draw? What does drawing give you? And, you know, people say to me, well, why do you swim a lot? Do you feel like the answer to why you draw and why you swim are different or similar at all?
I think they're probably quite different in that, firstly, in that drawing is now my job, so that's changed my relationship to it in a way that I will never get back the original feelings that I had for drawing, because now they're tied up with survival and earning money and things like that. But swimming has always been something that was like pure enjoyment, even if it's exercise or whatever. I'm always enjoying it, and drawing isn't always enjoyable, although I love it. It's more like the person that you love that you kind of like, well, I love you, but sometimes you make my life miserable, or sometimes I don't understand you, but you do ultimately define my life. Whereas swimming is a break from that. It's pure enjoyment. And I like the break. I like the world of a swimming pool in whatever form that it's, whether it's going to the pond, going to a lighter, or going to an indoor pool. Each one of them is a little universe that you get to step into that has a different feeling to it than outside, which I like. Even going to the beach, but I'm not, like, I do like a sea swim, and I grew up in Devon, so I'm very used to being by the sea, but it's obviously, living in London, much rarer occurrence to swim in the sea these days. But yeah, it's enjoyment, and also the feeling. I think I what I get often from swimming is like a completely calm brain for a bit, which allows you, I don't know if I'm going to be able to explain this properly, but I sometimes feel like allows me to have my ideas sort of like swim with me. So if I'm thinking about something, I can be sat in my studio trying to work out a piece of writing or in a drawing, and then if I go for a swim, it's like the idea gets to stretch too, and I can, it like suddenly becomes clear, and I can sort of see it stretching down the lane in front of me almost, which really sounds indulgent, but is definitely what it feels like. I'm amazed at how often going to the pool allows me to kind of solve a problem, or gives me the opportunity to solve a creative problem, like, alarmingly quickly. And it's just putting your brain and body in a different mode, I suppose, less hunched, and suddenly you're loose and you're in the water and everything flows better, I guess. So swimming is also that, but it is mostly enjoyment. Whilst drawing feels compulsive, habitual, necessary. It's how I communicate. I think mostly it has historically all my life. I would say that drawing has been like the way that I explain how the world feels to me, and that's how you relate to people. It's a very special thing to be able to show people how you see in a very neat way. Like, this is a drawing of how I see you, or this house, or this day. It's a nice thing to be able to do, and I feel lucky in that respect. But it is, all the nice things are tied up with a lot of other complicated things as well, whereas swimming feels uncomplicated.
I really relate to that. And I guess cliches are cliches for a reason, because things do flow better with movement, and swimming is so wonderful for that. You also mentioned that wherever you swim, it feels like its own universe, which reminds me of two illustrations that you've done that I think are both quite funny. I think your drawings have got quite a lot of humor in them. One is just called 20 Swimming Pools, and it's just blue shapes, which kind of speaks to how swimming can be so different while also being the same, which I really like. And also this one, you have like a very long bathtub and a woman doing front crawl in the bathtub, which I just find so funny, of just that that compulsion to...
That was a lockdown drawing.
Was it? Yeah, just feeling trapped and having the compulsion to move. And I feel like lots of us, that drawing sums up what it feels like to be in our head a lot of the time.
Yeah, that was very much the... Also, we lived in an attic flat we had a bath, but it was like a micro bath. It was ridiculous. And it was just like, I just want to be submerged and moving in water. Where could I? You know, people were getting into their wheelie bins filled with water and doing that kind of like to get the cold water experience. Like friends with children who got paddling pools, and I was like, oh, could I come and swim in a paddling pool? Yeah, I got quite deranged at that point, I think. Craving a swim, so the bath was the really long bath was the manifestation, all I wanted, and it would be great, a really long single lane bath.
I don't know though, I always see those like long pools you can get at home where people have like a current they can go against, so they're just swimming in one space, and I get that that's incredibly space efficient, but also think, oh, I would just be horrified. That part of what's nice about swimming is not having that restriction and being able to move. But I guess that's a different kind of swimming, isn't it? That's training. That's athleticism at that point.
Yes, it's a different thing. I'm not doing that.
Yeah. And you mentioned as well that swimming gives you a very calm brain. And one thing that I thought was interesting was I listened to you in an interview talking about setting Alison in kind of like the 50s, 60s, 70s, partly so that you didn't have to illustrate phones. And one of the things I love about swimming is that I don't have my phone with me when I'm there. It's a break from being on my phone, and I hate to admit it, but like all of us, I'm just incredibly addicted to being online all the time. And yeah, I just thought that was very interesting. Do you find that the same with part of why swimming creatively frees you?
Yeah, totally. I mean I've probably not really put the two things together, because it's probably as much as there's like how you are physically relaxed, I think a lot of that is probably also due to your distance from technology. Yeah, it's really nice knowing that your phone is locked in a locker or in a bag by the side of the water. You don't have to engage with it at all. And as long as you keep swimming, it doesn't exist. Yeah, it's definitely nice. And for the book, I suppose it was a more of a visual decision. Like, I didn't want... We can't avoid phones and computers in our lives. So much of our communication happens that way. But I didn't want to draw them. They're not visually appealing. I couldn't think of a way of making that look fun and interesting. And also, they also solve a lot of problems quite quickly narratively, like in our lives. I wanted the story to feel quite real. So if the reality in a lot of situations is just that you send a text message and the problem is solved, and I didn't want the problems to be solved. I wanted to keep the problem. So I got rid of phones. No phones. It would be nice if someone just turned them off. There was a switch. Just, oh no, we've lost it. It doesn't work anymore. We'd all be so happy, but we can't do it voluntarily. I don't think I've got the willpower to opt out. So swimming will do.
There's this fantastic, I'm not sure what you'd call him, scientist, philosopher, author called Johann Hari, who talks about our attention spans and says that basically for every decision of willpower that you need to unsubscribe or step back from technology, there's 1,000 engineers making very smart decisions to stop you doing that. So alone, we simply don't have the willpower. We need a movement or some kind of social uprising to say enough is enough. And I was very interested in that idea because I'm always trying to bargain with myself. I'll say 10 minutes of, you know, screen limit on Instagram, and then I'll have a week where I delete it from my phone. And I feel very defeated that I have to do these small things and end up giving up. But maybe a more positive way to look at it is that when I go for a swim, I am reclaiming that time, however short it is, for myself. Because it often does feel like another thing we're doing to beat ourselves up about is I'm so bad with my phone. I'm so bad at screen time.
Yeah, definitely. I think as with many things that relate to capitalism, that responsibility lands on the individual when it's a problem that comes from the outside that's being forced upon us, I suppose, by tech companies or whatever. Yeah, and that idea that it's all on you isn't really fair. You don't really get the option to opt in every time. Yeah.
And you've now made this physical book that lives in the world, and then also have to have, you know, we kind of get told this myth that we also have to be online for that to work as well. Do you feel pressure with that to create almost like extra work that exists just for this separate realm on social media?
Not so much because my work generally relies on being online and presenting my work often, how, you know, in order to get commissions, in order to get illustration jobs, I have to be visibly working. So I'm quite used to that. I graduated in 2009. So from then on, I've probably been very online, although in a way that I try and control as much as possible. I hope it's not excessive, but so I'm quite used to it. So I think that pressure didn't really arise. I think if you were someone who'd been writing privately and in a contained way for a long time, and then suddenly had to be visible on Instagram or Twitter or something, it would be a shock. And I personally would find it quite counterintuitive, but I think it's become part of my day-to-day process at this point, so I didn't notice it so much. And I never felt pressured to do any of that. It's always like, oh, if you want, but don't feel like you have to. And obviously on a personal basis, you kind of want people to buy your book, so you're aware you have to do some stuff.
What?
Oh, no. Oh, no. Enjoy. Yeah, but it has to feel natural, doesn't it, the way you use all that stuff. And I think I'm always trying to be, I would never, like, thinking about, like, oh, how would I phrase this if I was saying it to someone else in a room? I'll write it like that rather than something too perky or professional sounding. I want to use social media like a real person as much as possible.
Oh, I love your paintings. I love seeing the ones of swimming or of people in bubble hats and swimsuits, or also of books, because you paint all my favourite things. So I love seeing them. And it brightens up what can often make, I find Instagram can be quite a place that makes me feel quite stressed. And actually art is one of the things that gives me a lot of joy when I see it. And I wanted to ask you as well about being from Devon. Maybe you could tell me some of your favourite places to swim in Devon.
Oh my gosh. So I grew up just outside Plymouth, which when you're growing up, wherever you grow up is unsatisfactory, but then feel very lucky to get to go back there and to have access to Dartmoor and to all of the coast of South Devon. So there are places we used to swim on Dartmoor when we were younger, kind of, I think, the spot for nearest to us was Cadover Bridge. There was it's like a bit of river, and we would always walk. It's maybe a slightly antisocial family. We would walk further away, and there was a bit of kind of wooded river that was nice to like paddle and sort of mess around in. But then we would swim at Mothercombe, which is sort of past Yelverton. Somewhere. I don't drive, so my geography is terrible. I just rely on other people. to drive me around. But so still when I get him, my mum and I will often drive to Mothercombe for a swim. And there are two beaches there. There's one that's more on the estuary and then there's one around the corner that was, when we were growing up, was private and you couldn't access it. And now you can. And it's lovely, like a really beautiful little kind of cove, quite wide. But it's a really nice swimming spot. And then Stoke Beach was another one that's a bit more of a mission. It's one of those Devon beaches where you park in a car park that's three spaces wide and then you walk down the steepest coastal path. But then you're in a very beautiful little cove with kind of rocky bits. Yeah, really nice. There's just so many, there's so many magical bits of coast. Obviously, we'd go down to Cornwall as kids in summer holidays. But even in Plymouth, like, there are really nice swimming spots. Obviously, there's like the sea pool that was
Devil's
refurbished.
Point.
And then there's Devil's Point. So Devil's Point is where we would go now if we were just, oh, we just want a quick swim in the sea. We would drive to Devil's Point, I think. But then also the sea pool, the Tinside, the kind of Art Deco pool on the front, which all of my childhood was closed. They didn't refurbish it till I left home. But it was always this tantalising thing. There's this kind of whole 1920s kind of seafront development on the Ho in Plymouth with kind of walkways and bits where you can sit. And obviously in the 20s and 30s, and they would all have had tables and little cafes and bars and things. And they were just sort of abandoned and left for, the whole of my childhood. And you'd walk along the seafront and look at them. And I love the thing about being by the sea, all those different levels and kind of, you get it naturally forming in rock faces. We're like, oh, we could sit on that level of rock or that level. It's kind of higgledy-piggledy and chaotic and very inviting. And this was like the man-made version of that, steps and stuff. And it looked really fun, almost like a platform game, like a Mario game or something, like something like that. But yeah, now they're sort of, the pool was refurbished and there's some of that has been perked up a bit. But it's an amazing spot, just looking out to the Plymouth Sound. And I think more could be done with it. But maybe that's true of a lot of Plymouth at the moment.
Yeah, I remember visiting Tinside Lido, and as you see it from a distance, just this like jewel of bright blue. And like you say, all these rocks and formations on the outside. And there was somebody who had climbed right down the kind of cliffside and was jumping from the cliffs into the water right below the Lido. And it was so rocky and looked so adventurous and wonderful. And to have this view where you've got people swimming in the Lido, people swimming on the rocks, people swimming in the sea, and all the different types of water there, it was just wonderful. And I'm so pleased that there's been a real cold water renaissance there and in many places.
Yeah, people never swam in the sea in like Devil's Point and stuff growing up. It would be mad. You'd go to one of the kind of more family beaches, but you wouldn't swim in Plymouth so much. And now that's really changed, which is obviously, I guess, like a lot of places, a lot of that is due to the lockdowns. But I hope it stays, because it does make the city feel like it reaches further. It's a nice thing.
Yeah, it was about this time last year, actually, that I went there. And me and my friend were there to visit Devil's Point and have a swim. And there were two girls, young girls, cousins in wetsuit shorties. And one of them said to the other, they were like splashing and floating and playing all kinds of fun games. And one of them said to the other, swimming's like flying, isn't it? And it was, I just thought it was so sweet. And beyond, there was a family with flasks, sat watching the waves. There was a dog walker throwing a ball into the sea, and then a group of paddle boarders kind of almost skated past. And it was when Devil's Point had just had its spring clean, because apparently it got quite smelly and mossy, and it felt like everyone was out to have their own spring clean as well. And I love that this time of year, when everybody's out with this determination to be outside and brush away the cobwebs and enjoy nature, and it feels like a lovely place to do it.
Yeah, it's really nice. I do enjoy going back there. I was back in the start of March, but it was absolutely freezing and I didn't have any gloves and stuff with me. So just walked past, but there were people out there. And you get that, I think, as a swimmer, regardless of the situation. If you see someone else swimming, you're like, oh, I could be doing that. Why aren't I doing that? And even I get it, like I'll have swum, I'll have got out the water, dried off, got dressed, and then I'll see someone else walking in and be like, can I go again? You know, like you do get a bit addicted and you do just always want to be doing it. So yeah, even though it was legitimately freezing, it's one of those really cold weeks in March, in early March, but just seeing someone walk down in their wetsuit was tantalizing. I could just pop in.
Oh, well, after our chat today, I feel very compelled to the water. So thank you so much for joining and for chatting to me about everything swimming.
Thanks so much for having me, and I'm really looking forward to reading your book.
So that was Lizzie. I hope you enjoyed our chat. Definitely check out her Instagram for gorgeous illustrations, including the watery ones I mentioned. You can find Alison wherever you buy your books, and I'm very excited to visit the beaches she mentioned in Devon. Thanks again to this episode's sponsor, Tryhard. Say goodbye to chlorine and shop their skin and hair products at 15% off with the code TIDAL. See you at the next episode.